Ladies and gentlemen, this is Jay Booksbaum. You know me probably from wine and spirits, but I want to tell you something. Even though I'm in that area of expertise, you're about to hear from Rahama Bistritsky-Klapman, who runs MASS, Mothers and Fathers Aligned Saving Kids. They're in their 20th anniversary. They've got over 45,000 families that they've helped over the years. It's an amazing program. It's called Family Matters. And if you've got any issues with bullying or alcohol or substance abuse or any other kind of abuse, they're your place to go. I'm really excited to introduce you all to Rahama Bistritsky-Klapman here on Dev Brenner's Talkline Communications Network every Thursday night at 9 o'clock. Listen to Rahama and Family Matters.
Good evening and welcome back to MASK's radio show on Family Matters. So for those that are not aware of what MASK is a helpline, a referral agency. We offer support groups. We have in-school programs. We do staff training, camps, school, parent events, and community events. MASK is Mothers and Fathers Aligned Saving Kids. We just had our 20th anniversary, and we're stronger than ever. We are here to help parents. Over 45,000 parents reached out to MASK over the 20 years to try and help their loved ones. Write down our number. Maybe you need it. Maybe a friend needs it. Maybe somebody you sit next to in shul needs it. Our number is 718-758-0400. And our helpline is available from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. It's confidential. You don't even have to give your name. Call, ask your questions on any mental health issues, addiction, anything that you're struggling with that you may need a referral for, you may need a support group for. And in case we don't have that answer for you that you may need, there are many organizations that MASK will refer you to that can get you the help for your loved one or yourself. This evening's show is a very, very important show on mental health and addictions. And we are very, very privileged to have with us tonight my good friend, Jerry Anna from Paradigm. Jerry Anna, good evening.
Good evening, Rahama. I'm so happy to be back. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me, Jerry Anna. And we have Sydney Weiss. Sydney Weiss travels the world. She is one of the very rare people that are nationally certified in mental health and addiction recovery coaching. She is the most requested addiction person that I know of, actually. Jerry Anna, you too?
Yes. Of course, yes. One of the most sought-after addiction coaches, interventionists throughout the entire country.
Yes, and I would like to welcome with us tonight Sydney Weiss. Good evening, Sydney.
Good evening. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm so honored and privileged to be here.
So, Sydney, it's wonderful to have you, and I would like our listeners to understand first what is a recovery coach? Because, you know, when a parent is faced with a child struggling, sometimes they'll call their neighbor, their best friend, someone that they think may have struggled with a child. And not all cases are the same. Not all families are the same. So, Sydney, first, let's talk. What is a recovery coach? What is the definition, and what exactly does it entail to become a client of a recovery coach like yourself?
Recovery coaching is a form of strength-based support for people with addiction or in recovery from mental health issues, alcohol, other drugs, codependency, or other addictive behaviors.
So if there is a child that is struggling with addiction and they're 17 years old, how can a recovery coach help the family?
I think an interventionist would probably be a more appropriate
term.
And how they could help the family is by very quickly, because you know the 18th birthday coming up means the person will then be able to make all their decisions on their own because they're an adult. So
very important, very important. Thank you for bringing that up, Sydney. Parents don't realize when they call the helpline that they need to move fast with that underage child. Thank you for bringing that up.
Oh, yes, very fast. So the earlier the call comes in, the better it is. So if your child is turning 17 and they're doing drugs, pick up the phone.
Right. They can pick up the phone to Mass, and we will give out your information. They can call the Mask helpline and 718-758-0400. So can you walk us through the process for an underage child? Family calls you. You are the interventionist. How can you help that family with the 17 to 15-year-old child that is addicted to drugs, that the family's looking for guidance and support? What would you send them?
Okay. I would immediately meet with them as quickly as possible, and I think one of the most important things at first is to tell them that I am myself in recovery, long-term
recovery. Thank you for sharing. Thank you.
Yeah, so that they know that somebody that's been through this has gone through what their child is going to go through. And that you know, there's real caring involved in this. This is not a business transaction. You know, this is a caring situation where we're going to work together, and you know, I'm almost temporarily going to be part of your family for a while. So
you meet with the family, you do an intake with the parents. You get all their background and information, and then the next step is?
Well, the next step is to, before we even get involved with the child, I learn all about the child from them, but then, in the intake, as you just said, is to choose the treatment center. And you don't choose the treatment center off the internet, and you don't choose a treatment center, as you said earlier, from your neighbor or your friend or your rabbi or rabbi's brother's neighbor's best friend's sister. You do it by calling a professional. For example, I myself and people like myself who are interventionists should, I personally have visited almost 200 facilities, visited and vetted them, where I met the clinicians and know whether it's a good place or not. Now, that doesn't mean I would send people to all those places, because some of them were terrible. And that's the reason why they need to be vetted, because what you see on the internet, they're just ads. And it's fine to buy dog food and TVs off the internet, but you don't buy something that this important off the internet.
Yes, very important. Parents call Mask, and they'll say, can you give me a name of a rehab where I could send my child? And Mask also doesn't believe in a parent picking that name alone. It's not about calling a helpline and just getting a name. It's about meeting with an addiction professional first, whether it's the family, the parent, the loved one, the spouse. Very often a spouse calls. Very often an addict themselves may call the helpline, and they'll say, I need help. I'm addicted to gambling. I'm addicted to porn. I'm addicted to drugs. I need help myself. Where can I go? At that point, MASC will refer them to either somebody like yourself, Sydney, or to the drug therapist in their community closest to their home that they can get to easily, and to, or to an outpatient clinic, depending, of course, on their finance and their insurance. So when we get that, when we refer them to you, Sydney, a parent will call, their child is 17, we'll go back to that 17 age, and you'll meet with the parent. You also, like MASC, recommend groups for parents. Gerianna?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
Gerianna, and do you want to talk about the power of groups and the power for parents to be empowered about underage children? That's where you come in, Gerianna, your specialty.
Right. And I think that, the first of all, I just want to point out, Sydney said something so wise that we try to do key members in our organization, and that is, from the very beginning, the first time that a parent is brave enough to make a phone call, what we try to do is share our own journeys. You know, many of us have are in recovery and have battled a lot of the addictions that are prevalent among teens and adults, the things that folks are struggling with. And so we try to comfort as much as we can right off the bat so that the healing process can really begin to take off, and people can start to feel empowered and understand that they're no longer alone because they've been brave enough to make that initial phone call to MASC, for example. And so, again, you know, the more information that we can arm our families with and let them know that, look, we're all in this journey together, we're a member of your family. One quote that has been said about Sydney, for example, that I just love, that I was sharing with you, Rahama, earlier, is that one quote is about Sydney Weiss: she is a hunter for the beauty in all of us. And I just think that's a wonderful, lovely common thread that all of us as clinicians or interventionists, addiction counselors, that we all have that commonality among us. And the more that we can reassure our parents that you are no longer alone, we're all in this together, only good things can happen from that starting place.
Thank you, Gerianna. Absolutely. We're all here to help the families, our listeners. We are listening to Family Matters. I'm Rahama Bistritsky-Klantman, and we have Gerianna on the phone with us and Sydney Weiss. Our number is 718-758-0400. You can call with any of your questions. Our helpline is open 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Sydney, I'd like to get back to speaking about what happens when a child is over 18 years old, maybe 34 years old, married with a child. Can you help those families as well?
Oh, absolutely.
And what are the limitations once they're over 18 working with a married child?
There's only one difference, really. One major difference is the element of choice. I do like to give even a 15-year-old the chance to make a choice, but if they choose no, we still make them go. So, but it is, I think, a way of just giving them dignity and doing that. But you did ask about an older person, so I will answer that. Working with a married person, so the spouse normally is usually the person who would call. That's usually how it happens. And the person probably has been using drugs or alcohol or whatever it might be, the porn, whatever it might be, for a good long time. It's very rare that people start all of a sudden in their 30s. So, it's a much more entrenched addiction. Has much more of a hold, and there's more, depending on the length of the marriage, if there's children, etc. You know, the family dynamics are more dysfunctional, I would say, because of the more time that's gone on with the problem.
And that could include more secrets.
That's exactly what I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, if somebody is doing drugs or addicted to porn and now they're getting married, that could become an issue in their marriage. Not always does the wife know, or the husband, if it's the wife doing it. Not always does the spouse know about it before the marriage. So it could be many months, sometimes immediately, and sometimes many months later, when faced with trauma or something, and a family member can have a relapse. Can you talk about the relapse in these kind of cases, please?
In general addiction or porn in particular?
No, general addiction.
Okay.
First.
Relapse is very common, and relapse is part of recovery. I don't say that as an excuse or that everybody is going to or will, you know, should relapse, but I say that because we need to guard against it, because it's so common. So there is no person in recovery that's doing it right that is not, you know, working with a professional over a long period of time to identify triggers and relapse triggers and to find replacements for those. An example of a trigger for, a drug addiction would be going down the street where your drug dealer used to be, standing on the corner. So you just don't, you go a different way. And also finding, you know, healthy activities, because certain of these addictions, porn is one, the biggest time waster, I would say, take up so much time that they're left with you know, huge gaps of time ahead of them with very little to do. And it can't all be going to groups and going to, there has to be life also. So maybe, you know, back in the day when they were 12, they played the guitar. So they pull that dusty guitar out and play it, and they get the same wonderful feeling that they had when they were, you know, children, playing guitar. And even dopamine might be released, oxytocin, and chemicals that are released when they do drugs. So doing pleasurable activities like that, and of course exercise has been, hundreds of research studies release those same chemicals, so that's very recommended as well.
Thank you, Sydney. So basically, there's so much information that a parent needs to know to have. Knowledge is power. And I want to address the different addictions. Gerianna, do you want to help me out with that, please?
Yes, I would love to. I know as a parent myself, and for our parents who are listening in right now, who would like to better understand and delve more deeply into the different addictions, I'm wondering, Sydney, if you could please help us to understand, what is the most prevalent common teen addiction you have been seeing lately? And if you could just identify it for us first and break it down, that would be so helpful.
Without a doubt, unfortunately, heroin.
Okay. And if you could talk, Sydney, how does that first manifest? What are the triggers that causes a young person to gravitate towards that type of addiction in particular?
Okay. It first manifests in, one of two ways. One way I call the more innocent road, which is the person has a sports injury or similar, and they are prescribed opiate painkillers. and they become addicted to those, and they're incredibly physically addictive, so it's not even just the mental component anymore. It's not the obsession compulsion only, but it's physical. And then the doctor stops prescribing it, and they're a teen. They don't have much money, so they cannot afford to buy, you know, these pills on the street that go for $25
right.
each. So they they buy instead a bag of heroin, which goes from, you know, 5 to 15, depending where you live, and way more bang for the buck. And usually they start out by snorting it, and fairly soon after end up injecting it.
So for those parents that don't even know what snorting is, can you describe what a person does?
What they do is they take, it comes in a little glassine bag, and they empty it out, and they make it into like a line, like a little, just like a, you know, on a table or on a mirror, and then they roll up a dollar bill or a piece of paper and inhale it through their nose. So it's nasally administrated, and, people do smoke it as well, but that's more of a West Coast thing with black tar heroin. They don't really have that here, so I didn't think that was important to bring up too much about.
Okay. Okay, and what about, let's start, go a little backwards. What about those kids that sell their Ritalin, sell their medication to friends, doing weed? Can you describe for our listeners what and how that works?
Okay. Well, the ones that are selling their medication are obviously not taking their medication, so they don't have an addiction problem, generally, unless they're trading it for something else. And the ADD meds work in teens completely differently than they do in adults. So you often find adults buying from, unfortunately, from teens or from people that know teens, their ADD meds, because they will get an adult high, like a speedy kind of a high, whereas in a teen, it will actually calm them down. So it's an ADHD medication, and it will help them focus. And they don't want to be calmed down because they want to have energy for being a teen. So that's why they do that. And weed's usually the first drug, weed and or alcohol. And the most interesting statistic and the most important statistic I think parents need to know, can I just say it because it's so important, is that if a kid does not drink or smoke pot by the age of 24, the chances of them becoming an addict are almost nil, no matter how many other people in the family are addicted. But if the opposite occurs, and it's at 15 or younger, the chances are very high that they will become an addict, even if nobody in the family is an addict. I don't know the exact numbers, but it's something like 4 times higher than if they were never to, if they were not to do it, or, you know, either one.
Right. A lot of parents, Sydney, will call up and say, you know, my son or my daughter, my married child has an addiction. They went into rehab 28 days, and we paid so much money for those 28 days. And, you know, she comes home, and now she seems to be going back to those friends that she had before, and we're very scared. Or they were in rehab for 60 days, and we're very scared. Can you elaborate on the importance of the length of stay in a rehab and the outpatient discharge plan, why that is most important before you take your child home?
Oh, it's critical. The statistics show that 3 months is the magic number. 90 days compared to 60 days is like 10 times more effective. So that's pretty dramatic. There's something about those last 30 days in the 90 that are absolutely critical.
Can I interrupt you and just tell our listeners that the first 30 days generally, when they're in rehab, they really don't want to be there. Somebody put them there, unless it's a very motivated child, a married person, an adult, somebody that's very motivated, wants to go 28 days, be in an intensive outpatient 3-day-a-week program, goes to their meetings, has their sponsors. Really, the first 30 days, unless they're those motivated clients, really, they don't learn much because they so don't want to be there. They're also detoxing at the time. They've come in detox. They really don't want to be there. They're fighting. They're fighting their family, their parents. They're angry. They want their drug. The second set of 30 days, they're now feeling their body without those drugs in it. They're clean for the first time, some of them in 10 years, some of them in 3 years, some of them in 1 year, in 6 months. But suddenly they're feeling their body without their drug that they've been constantly leaning on, taking their crutch to get through their day. And then by the third month, Sydney, what you're describing, that magic last 30 days in the 90-day graduation day, those 30 days are the most critical days for inpatient clients, because that's when they start the learning process. Isn't that so, Sydney?
I couldn't agree more, and I always say do not quit before the miracle, and the miracle happens in 90 days or more. It doesn't happen before that. It's so rare. You're right. The person that not only has to be you could be so motivated, but still have so many things going against you. You could have saboteurs in your family that are bringing drugs in. You know, that are. I mean, there's just a million things that are. It's a disease that tells you that you don't have a disease. It's a cunning, baffling, powerful thing. It's a brain disease, and it is, you know, the person is a sick person. They're not a bad person, but they need the time to get better. So the first, like you said, 30, 60 days, you know, that's still the ER. You know, they're not even in the ICU. So, you know, they really need to be in the recuperation, you know, for as long as possible, and really learn how to live with the uncomfortability of feelings without their drug or the behaviors of choice, and learn that, and have what we call sober references, where, oh, I went through this painful feeling without any drugs, without any porn, and I'm okay. So that if I can do it once, I can do it 1,000 times. And that's so important. And you just can't do that in 30 days when, like you said, especially if they're still detoxing, if they're on drugs that take that long to detox from. Marijuana is in your system for exactly 30 days. So forget that. That's why bother even going for 30 days? There's no point. I mean, there really isn't. And marijuana is a very serious addiction these days. People of, you know, older generations, you know, Woodstock hippies and people, you know, that type of marijuana is not what is grown today. What is grown today is 67 times stronger than what those people in the film Woodstock were smoking and dancing around that you watched, and they look pretty high to me, but now we're talking about 67 times more. And, you know, there's, because the methods of growing them have become so much more advanced, just like any other scientific thing.
Thank you, Sydney. You know, I have to say, for the parents who are listening like me, who are probably a little bit on the edge of their seats, wondering, you know, what did I do in my parenting style at home? What could I have done to contribute to this addiction to marijuana, addiction to heroin? And as you've said so articulately, look, this is a brain disease. If you can just speak about that, about the environmental impact of developing one of these addictions, whether it be heroin or cocaine, pornography, which we're going to get into a little bit later on the show. If you could speak to that specifically, I think that would be a really good information for our parent listeners, please.
Okay. Number one, addiction is a genetically transmitted disease, and so it's a lot of nature and a little of nurture. You see families with multiple addicted people or the people in recovery. If you really start to look at it, you realize that yes, I do see this statistic in real life. Most parents didn't do anything wrong. Some, of course, did, but I would say blaming oneself for the past is not productive, and moving forward to the future is, and learning what you can do now. And I can give you a whole list of things. I have a list of 10 things that parents can do.
Please tell us. Okay. Yes. Okay. And I think, and before you get into the 10, Sid, I think it's really great information as parents. I'll speak for myself as well, that, look, nobody's parenting style is perfect. You know, we all work hard to be the best listeners, the best nurturers that we can be with our children, but there's going to be a natural trigger that occurs that's just life. You know, it could be a death of a loved one within the home. Something's going to happen to trigger something. And so I think it's really great information for parents to realize that we've worked with so many parents that blame themselves, that have so much years of guilt and shame. And it's really, like Rahama was saying, knowledge is power. And if we can just make sure that all our parent listeners feel empowered that, look, this isn't something that you directly caused to happen here to your child. So if you can just go into the 10, that would be great.
I will. And I just want to say something personal about that, because my father recently died, and he put alcohol down. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But he put alcohol down before I was born. My mother made it a condition of their marriage. So he was a very serious alcoholic, and he put it down, and he never touched it again. At generations, we have his father was an alcoholic. The brother had committed suicide. All these different from the generation before on that side of the white side of the family. So. And what he said to me before he died was, I, first of all, we were just talking about many things, and, he knew he was going to die. Anyone who's 86 knows they're going to die anyway pretty soon, but he had a disease. And he said, thank you for educating me about addiction, because, frankly, in all these 50 years, I really, over 50, I've wanted to drink a lot. And I never, wanted to say that before, but... I'm really proud of you for your recovery, and I maybe I should have done it the way you did it. I always thought all these things were therapy and groups and I don't need anybody, I can do this on my own kind of thing. But the most important thing he said is, it wasn't my fault, it wasn't your fault. If I need to blame it on anyone, it's 50 generations before. So let's just not blame anybody, Let's just, accept that, maybe there's a reason for this, and maybe there's a really good reason, and look what you're doing now. Maybe that's the whole reason why the whole Weiss family had to have this problem, so that you could help people. Who knows? So I thought that was beautiful.
Oh, what a blessing. And that's my prayer for all of our listeners, and I know Rahama feels the same way, that we can have more of those kinds of honest conversations among family members, because the healing power is just so transformative. So thank you, Sydney, for sharing that blessing.
Thank you for sharing your personal story. And yes, we all want families to heal. And the main message that we need to drill through to everybody everywhere is stigma-free. We need to be able to take off our masks.
Yes.
That is on my list of 10. Exactly.
Right.
Should I read the list?
Yes. Right.
Okay.
And
number one, learn as much as you can about addiction. Knowledge is power, as you guys have been saying. Number two, connect with understanding peers, whoever they are, but some understanding peer. It might be going to Al-Anon, it might be going to MASC, it might be whatever it is. Three, family therapy, intervention, etc. Prepare meals and eat together, and no booze at the table. That's number five. Manage your expectations for this whole thing, because there will be disappointments. Even if there isn't a relapse, there's going to be disappointments. And because life is full of disappointments, and just because somebody went to rehab and got sober doesn't mean everything's going to be perfect, because the whole rest of the family who has been working on their problems at the same time. But everybody has problems, so manage those expectations. Each person is responsible for their own personal joy, stress reduction, and coping skills. So things like playing instruments and hiking and all those things that we sort of brought up before, volunteering, whatever, you know, type of healthy activity that gives you personal joy as a complete human being without needing anybody else. Exercise, because of the science of that. Good sleep hygiene. Having some sort of private either therapy, recovery coach, parent coach, parent effectiveness training, PET, something like that. And the last thing is educate and advocate against the stigma. Language really matters. Like, they talk about clean, being clean and dirty. I mean, what kind of way is that to talk about a person? That's not, you know, and the war on drugs and things like that. Just very strong, aggressive words. And words really do matter. So being Jewish people, you know, education is important to us. I know it's certainly was to my family and to the families that in the town I grew up in, which was predominantly Jewish. And I always learned that words are very important. So be careful, you know, don't say anything to people that you wouldn't want said to you. And also, don't self-talk negatively to yourself. You know, saying, people in their own head say, I'm a bad parent. Stop that. Just stop it in its tracks and make up another thing and make it positive. I'm grateful for blank, for example.
Right. And Sydney, I just want to interject this quickly. Important to note that with negative self-talk, isn't that one of the more common things that are passed down from parent to child? A lot of children who are used to hearing their parents growing up in the home, not even thinking about it, but calling themselves stupid or, gosh, that was a dumb thing to do. Why did I do that? I'm an idiot, whatever. And kids start to pick up on that. Isn't that true?
That is so true. And it's also when the parent talks to the other parent that way in a dismissive fashion and things like that, they also pick up on that. So if the wife belittles the husband or vice versa, you might see, let's say the wife belittles the husband, you might see the daughter belittling her first boyfriend. So those are things we don't want to carry into or even her brother, her little brother. And we don't want a daughter to belittle her brother.
Right. Thank you.
Sydney, thank you very much. Thank you for sharing your personal story. I want to just speak about how you were saying about the guilt and the language. Dr. Abe Tversky always said that parents should leave the guilt, dump it in the garbage can closest to where you are, and put your head up and get your child the help he may need or she may need. Not always is the client, the child, the loved one, the spouse, ready to do the work. So it's very hard on parents. Not always are two parents on the same page. What happens? You have a 30-year-old daughter. She must get into treatment. She's drugging. She's had trauma. She's been molested. Somebody died young in the family. Whatever it may be, what can that parent who does not have their spouse on the same page, how can we, those families, treatment for their loved ones?
Well, if you're working with a professional, I mean, the best way would be to set up a family, like, board of directors, so to speak, where the, you know, the professional is one of the co-chairs, and the person who wants to get help for the patient or client is the other. And everything has to go through them. Everybody gets notified of everything, but there have to be certain ground rules. So, for example, the teen cannot call that other parent, take me out of here, because they will. So, you know, and the treatment center, and because the professional knows this, the professional will be talking to the treatment center. The treatment center will be ready for these calls. You know, they'll be there. The kid won't be able to just make willy-nilly calls. They'll have a phone list of people they're allowed to call on.
Yeah, but what about when, before that, just to get the child into the treatment? When the father or the mother says, you know, I really don't believe in inpatient. Or, and this is a child that's older, in the 30s, in their 40s, and one of the parents are just not on board. So there's no real cooperation. There's no one road. How can
I've left, you know, left people out of it. They can be left out of the situation, and it has to go ahead. I mean, it has to go forward, as you know. The person needs that help. So there, where there's a will, there's a way. And if a professional's involved, they will know the way. If there's not a professional involved, it's harder, but it's still possible. I mean, there, you know, somebody who wants to get their kid help that badly, you know, they'll be like a football player. They'll be, you know, running around the defensive people and getting to the goal.
That's parents call, but there are many times other people call, family relatives. And by mask, we tell all the relatives that call, or the next door neighbor, or the rabbi, or the rabbitson, or a grandparent, that mask is mothers and fathers aligned saving kids. We believe, our belief system is, the mom and the dad need to be the ones getting their child the help they need. Now, everything is confidential on the MASC helpline. So if a grandparent calls and then says, I want help for my child, my grandson, my granddaughter, we always advise that grandparent to have the parent call. But there is a place for everybody else once the parent makes the decision on what to do. Should we go to Sydney? Should we have Sydney help us coordinate an intervention? Should Sydney take over and have the family listen to the direction of whatever Sydney's guidance, her guidance of what rehab, what sober living home? Should they go into an inpatient program or an outpatient program? Then you would include family members, grandparents, anybody that could help in an intervention. Is that how it works by you, Sydney, right?
I am a firm believer that the more anyone that wants to have in the family that wants to help should be included in that. Even if they're not blood family. You know, somebody that you call an aunt, but they're not really an aunt, they should be there. You know, the best friend of the mother. They should be there if they're part of that person's upbringing. If they're part, you know, that they, you know, an older cousin, a whatever. I mean, just, you know,
could be a counselor. It could be from camp. It could be a teacher, right? It could be an old friend from when they were younger. But we do recommend that whoever can should be at that intervention, but only after Sydney or whomever you trust, one professional, one addiction counselor, one counselor that deals with the gambling or the porn or the addiction or mental health issues, one person helps those parents make the decisions, and then the rest of the family members can come on board. For those
as long
that
as
are just
they're not drunk or high, yes. I mean,
I'm sorry, Sydney.
Don't want people coming that are going to disrupt the situation, but yes.
Right.
Right.
So that, I'm Gerianne, I'm just wondering if you want to describe how somebody gets admitted to one of your inpatient programs.
Yes, of course. You know, a lot of times families will call and, you know, they'll have a concern that their child is, you know, shutting down, not wanting to attend school anymore, and they had only known their child to be enthusiastic and be on the swim team or do something in the drama club, enjoyed school, and then all of a sudden they haven't been wanting to go, and they're not sure if there's an addiction involved. They're not sure, you know, what is happening, but the behavior has drastically changed. And so they'll call and they'll say, you know, I'm not really sure, though, that we need something that's a residential inpatient for 30 to 45 days. You know, I'm not sure what we're really dealing with here. And though we have everybody that calls us to come in and meet our clinical team and just to take a tour, bring your child with you and see the other children that we have, just to get a feeling for everything, get all of the information. A lot of times parents, they're not ready, and their child isn't ready. And so they'll call us back, maybe a month will pass or 2 months, and then sometimes 3 months will go by, and they'll call and they'll say, you know what, it's very clear, we have a real problem here. We definitely need to get some attention. So of course we invite them in right away if they haven't already been, and they usually meet with our clinical director and then some of our therapy team members, the primary therapist, secondary therapist, and then the family therapists get involved. And we try to rally around everyone who's brave enough to say, you know what, I need to be proactive, I need to figure out what's happening, get to the root of my depression, my anxiety, what's happened with my trauma, whatever the case may be. We try to give people a safe place where everybody can breathe, get the proper evaluations done, get the proper testing done, get into the talk therapy, and then figure it out as a team together. But I think it's so important to note, just like you've said so often, Rahama, that once you make that initial phone call and you kind of break the ice and you say, enough of the fear. I'm not going to let fear control my life. I'm going to do something. I'm going to be active here. Then only goodness can happen from that point. It may get complicated. There may be painful days, but it's certainly moving forward on the healing journey. And so what we try to do within the 30 to 45 days when our youth come in after all the proper evaluations are done is we try to engage them as much as possible. You know, in addition to the talk therapy for the youth, the families are coming in on Family Therapy Day, which are Saturday with depression or traumas, addictions, and they can get comfort and realize, hey, other people have walked where I'm walking now, and I'm not so terrified. And so we do the pet training, as Sydney pointed out. That's really a key staple for how we approach the family therapy day with our moms and dads. And then even when our program finishes, generally around the 45-day mark, we continue that circle of healing, which is so important. We make sure the strong outpatient supports are all in place, and we think everything through together, not just the clinician, but the family, of course, has input, and we're always trying to empower our youth to find their voices and advocate for themselves. Hey, this makes the most sense to me. And we have free aftercare, which a lot of organizations do, so that you can always pick up the phone wherever you are and reconnect with a favorite therapist or coach that you had been working with. But again, I think it all comes back to that first all-important courage that we need to find to just break the ice and say, you know what, I can't take being alone. Nothing good can come from isolation. I need to take the first step toward the healing process.
Thank you, Gerianna. Yes, absolutely. And just to give an example of how MASS can help our listeners, we recently, at the beginning of May, we had a Shabbaton where we had Friday night dinner, Shabbos lunch, and Shalosh Sudot. We had together 133 very brave, courageous parents came out. We had people that were Shtreimel, people, modern families, far to the right, far to the left, and mainstream yeshivish. We had all kinds of parents that had the courage to join for a beautiful Shabbaton where they spent all weekend giving each other the courage to continue facing these most painful challenges with our loved ones. And we had amazing rabbis and professionals speak. And we will be doing it again, so anyone interested in coming to a Shabbaton of chizuk, of courage, to give each other the courage that you may need to face stigma around all mental health issues, to face the addiction that's taking on your entire family, because that's what happens. When one person is sick in a family, the whole family suffers. So you can call 718-758-0400. If you have any questions during the week, anytime, you can ask on our confidential helpline. You can ask for Gerianna or Sydney Weiss, and we will connect you both to them and any therapist or inpatient rehab, outpatient rehab, anything that you may need for your loved ones. Today we are so inundated in phone calls about family members, loved ones that are addicted to pornography. It's so easy on the iPhone, on your cell phones, your smartphones, on any phone, on the computer, at work. People are getting addicted to pornography, not on purpose, not intentionally, by mistake. They're sitting in their office and suddenly there's a pop-up. We must have these things eliminated from our phones by contacting MASC on ways that you can secure your children's phones and computers. Computers must be in a public place. So important. It should not be in your child's bedrooms. Put it in the kitchen. Make a safe place that you can walk by and keep checking, even after you have the securities in place. So write down our number, listeners. Maybe you know somebody that's related to you. Maybe you need it for yourself. Maybe you need it for a friend, a neighbor, somebody you sit next to in shul. Please write down 718-758-0400 for our MASC confidential helpline. And like I said, Sydney, earlier, and Gerianna, and our listeners, it is important that both parents be on the same page when dealing with a child or a adult, even if they're in their 40s and 50s. Family members need to be on the same page to get the treatment that they may need. If you're not on the same page, don't focus on your child, your loved one. Focus first on getting on the same page. And we have groups, Dr. Tversky, Dr. Tricia Tia, Sarah Kahan. We have groups that you can go to if you're not on the same page to get you on the same page. And we have divorced couples that come to MASC, parents of a child that they're divorced. We help them help their loved one. Not always.
All the time.
And, right. And not people. Always. Is it MASC that is helping? Sometimes we can't be the one, but we will connect our listeners to any professional that we know that possibly can be the shliach, the messenger, to help their family member, like Sydney, like Gerianna, and many, many others, that the 45,000 families over the 20 years that have reached out to MASC, call the first time anonymously. Maybe, you know, you're still scared, you don't have the courage to spill everything, to tell your family secrets. Just call MASC's helpline, describe a situation anonymously. Don't wait until it becomes a huge problem that is so out of control that you're at the end of your rope. Call early on. Call when the children are younger, in elementary age school. Call, we're in schools, we have programs. Call if your child is ADD. Call if they have a learning disability. Call if you see that there's a trauma, bullying. Last week's program on bullying with Dr. Rona Novick. Call if you know that there's an issue going on in the school-age child's life. Call if there's something going on young. Please, we're begging the parents, call early. There's so much one can do for prevention. Sydney, did you want to share with us your last message that you want to share on prevention for our listeners to have the courage to pick up the phone to reach out to you, Gerianna, or to MASC?
I do, because you brought up the porn addiction, and I have had three 14-year-old boys in the last several months. Two of them were arrested for looking at child porn. They're children. This is the society we live in today. So, and again, this is not... They were not doing this on purpose. These were not bad parents at all. These are like the best parents I've ever met in all three cases. The computer is in a public place, etc. But these porn sites are reaching out to people, and they're reaching out to children at this point. And particularly anybody on the spectrum or has ADHD, autism, Asperger's, they're very vulnerable to this, to the porn thing.
Yep.
So that's my message, is that please call MASC and find out how to set up the computer properly so that these messages cannot reach your children, because this is an addiction that happens by accident. That's exactly what I tell people too.
Thank you, Cindy. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. It's a real honor to have you on. I know how busy you are and how you travel the world. Thank you for all your great advice, and working with you is always wonderful. I really thank you for being on with us tonight.
I thank you.
Gerianna, I want to thank you.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you, and I want to thank all listeners for tuning in this evening. And every Thursday night from 9 to 10, our number is 718-758-0400. Call us so that we can try and be helpful to your family, to your loved ones. I want to thank you. Good Shabbos, and have a good night.